Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. Today on our show, a decision at legislature about how to zone a new private school in Jackson, and a uranium mine's pursuit to solve its financial woes using acid.
At today's prices, the performance of this mine is not sustainable.
Following an officer-involved shooting, Laramie reckons with whether lethal force was really necessary.
There were so many other options besides escalating that to the point of killing him.
And we'll join some bird lovers on one of the last rural bird counts in the U.S.
Shrikes take their insects, they impale them on barbed wire fences to show females how good they are at catching things.
Lots of great stuff coming up right here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. A private school with some notable political ties has gotten into a fight with Teton County over whether it can build a new campus to accommodate a growing population. The Jackson Hole Classical Academy teaches a back-to-basics curriculum with a slight religious bent. After repeatedly being denied a chance to build to a scale that school officials say is needed, the fight has come to Cheyenne, and legislators are involved. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
Teton County has some of the strongest zoning rules in the state, so the local opposition to growing the new school is not that big of a shock. The school wants to build in an area that is not zoned for such structures. But to longtime Senator Eli Bebout of Riverton, the lack of flexibility is unfair. Currently, the only thing listed in state law that does not fall under local planning regulations is energy development. Bebout drafted a bill that would include private schools.
Here you have a school that's got 100 to 150 children, very well educated, that wants to do what they want to do, which is have a private school. And they have the money to do it, they have the commitment to do it, they have the teachers to do it, they have the students who want to be there. And why we would not in Wyoming, the equality state, want to do what's fair? I think we should.
So why would Bebout get into the middle of this? It might have something to do with the fact that the facility is co-founded by Steve and Polly Fries, who are the son and daughter-in-law of Jackson billionaire Foster Fries, who you might recall ran for governor and has now become active in state politics. Teton County officials are furious about the legislation and say it takes away local control and is special interest legislation, which is unconstitutional. Teton County resident and lawyer Len Carlman made that point to a legislative committee this week.
It is special interest legislation. It undermines a basic principle of county planning, which is to look at everything. You weigh the private and the community interests, you find the balances that meet local needs, you live with the results, you correct and improve things over time.
Even Bebout admits this looks a lot like special legislation.
You know, and we're prohibited for Senator Landon and saying, Senator Landon, we're going to do this for you. That's pretty clear, and there's an issue there, potentially.
Slightly less than half the counties have strong zoning regulations, but Pete Obermueller, who is with the Wyoming County Commissioners Association, says taking away the power of the counties regarding such structures could lead to problems.
Something could be built by anybody at any time under those very broad definitions of providing some sort of education without any sort of oversight whatsoever. That's what concerns me. There may be a way to limit that further. As it stands, the language is quite broad and quite troubling.
The County Commissioners Association will take a position on the bill next week, but they are watching how it's amended. Senator Chris Rothfuss, a Democrat from Laramie, is leading the charge on that and already made one change in committee that could be a path forward for the school with the idea that local officials would still have some oversight. He wants private school buildings to be treated the same as public schools. That means there will be oversight by the county.
Any school built within this equity of protection and zoning would have to conform to the same standards, the same zoning requirements, the same setbacks, the same size of property and siting that our public schools do as well.
Rothfuss and others are now working on getting the particulars of that in law. But Steve Fries of the Jackson Hole Classical Academy thinks it's a good step forward.
To offer a full K-12 program with everything we want to provide the students, we do need over 100,000 square feet. And that's about what the high school building is. We're hoping we can build something that'll be a little lower profile than that.
He says he plans lots of landscaping to make it blend in with the current landscape and then also hide it from neighbors. Fries says the attitude of Teton County residents towards building projects is tough on those who want to do anything, no matter how positive.
You're familiar with the term NIMBY, which stands for not in my backyard. Are you familiar with the subspecies of NIMBY that lives in Jackson Hole?
I'm not sure I am.
It's called the banana. And I'm told people proudly accept this moniker, which stands for build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody.
Teton County Senator Mike Garou says this is why he is a sponsor of the bill. He's a former county commissioner who thinks activists and some in the community are stopping development beyond intentions. But he admits he has mixed emotions about the legislation.
I still am hoping for a local solution, a solution this should not be litigated, prosecuted, or tried, decided here. It should be done in Teton County.
He's hoping the bill will force sides to work together and find that solution. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Now turning to news in the southern part of the state. Last week, a grand jury decided not to indict Albany County Sheriff's Officer Derek Colling. In November, he shot and killed 39-year-old Laramie resident Robbie Ramirez. The jurors found the officer's use of lethal force was justified, but that doesn't mean the officer didn't have other options. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports.
What ended as a deadly exchange between Corporal Derek Colling and Robbie Ramirez started as a traffic stop. Ramirez was driving well below the speed limit, so Colling pulled him over. Ramirez refused to roll down his window when Colling approached the vehicle, according to body camera footage.
Roll your window down.
At a press conference, Albany County Undersheriff Josh DeBree said Robbie Ramirez left his window up and demanded to know why he'd been pulled over.
Here in the background, there's a lot of yelling from Mr. Ramirez inside the vehicle.
In those recordings, Ramirez's mom, Deborah Hinkle, hears a son who struggled with mental health challenges. He was likely scared and confused. And maybe that's why Ramirez fled the traffic stop. Officer Colling decided to follow him home. Ramirez got out of his truck in front of his apartment. He was upset but unarmed. Colling confronted him with a taser in one hand and a firearm in the other. That final moment could have been avoided, Hinkle says, had Colling answered her son's question.
I don't understand why he couldn't have just slowed it down and answered why he pulled him over.
She thinks it would have made all the difference had Colling attempted to de-escalate the situation. That's not a new concept, but in 2017, the International Association of Chiefs of Police recommended that de-escalation be officially incorporated into all use of force policies. It's not currently a part of the Albany County Sheriff's Office policy manual.
It would make a huge difference in a lot of confrontational situations like that, and I believe that's what needs to happen.
That point was driven home for Hinkle when a grand jury decided not to indict Colling.
Because there were so many other options besides escalating that to the point of killing him. Why wasn't that looked at more?
At a press conference this week, Albany County Attorney Peggy Trent explained that the criminal justice process is set up to evaluate whether the use of force was justified, not whether Colling could have done something else. Now that the criminal proceedings have concluded, Trent says it's time to wrestle with these questions.
How could this happen? What could we do differently?
The choices officers make in the field are in part shaped by policies and procedures and the training they receive. Trent says those are the responsibilities of Sheriff Dave O'Malley.
And it's on his shoulders of how he takes this and proceeds with his deputies. And I think he is, at this point, listening to what other actions could be implemented in the future.
Immediately following Trent's press conference, I walked across the hall to Sheriff O'Malley's office, but he was off-site at a meeting. Over email, O'Malley told me the matter was under review, and he declined to comment further until the process was complete. In the wake of Robbie Ramirez's death, the community has been organizing to demand solutions. Many in Laramie point to how the city's police handle mental health issues and their use of de-escalation. The question is, what's in their policies that isn't in the county sheriff's? I asked Laramie's police chief, Dale Stalder, to show me his department's manual.
So this is a 27-page policy that covers how officers can use each one of their force options.
That's 27 pages just on use of force out of a close to 400-page manual. And as recommended by the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the policy emphasizes de-escalation as an option.
But you notice in the beginning in the definition where we talk about de-escalation and command presence or verbal skills as being just as critically important as any of your other force options that exist.
He also showed me the section detailing how officers are expected to respond to individuals with mental health concerns.
We'd give our officers different ideas about how we would deal with maybe mental illness or crisis somehow.
It empowers officers to reach out to counselors or family members, or to do an emergency detention if that's what's needed. In contrast, the phrase mental health is only used once in the sheriff's policy manual, and there's no mention of de-escalation. Stalder says the police department is diligent about reviewing policies and procedures, and officers are constantly being evaluated and trained.
Our officers need guidance in how they do their job. They want guidance, because if you don't have policy, then guys are adrift out there.
Stalder says each month they review a different section of their manual and go through the whole thing every year. As for the Albany County Sheriff's Office policy manual, most of it hasn't been changed since 2016. That's according to the dates recorded on the document. Meanwhile, Deborah Hinkle says there's nothing she can do to get her son Robbie Ramirez back.
You know, and I just have to look at this event and say, okay, so obviously we need changes. So let's make changes.
Sheriff Dave O'Malley says he expects to announce his office's next steps in a week or two. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Next up, we'll hear two stories about the downhill skiing industry in the Mountain West. Stay tuned. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. We've been looking at the ski industry in recent weeks, its importance to our region as an economic driver, and the many changes it's facing right now. Today, companies are using technology to make bombing down a cold mountain faster, more fun, and way more comfortable. And that's changing what used to be a pretty basic sport. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie reports on what's gained and what's lost with all this new tech.
We're in a bustling ski factory west of the snowy Wasatch Mountains in Utah. Many of the workers here look like ski bums. We're talking beanies, beards, flannels, but they're hard at work crafting some of the most advanced skis in the world. I watch as wood and carbon fiber are smushed together in a giant red hot box.
Okay, so this is like the panini press for your ski sandwiches.
It is, yeah. I recommend not eating these, but yes.
That last voice belongs to Alex Hunt. He's the communications manager here at DPS Skis, and he says carbon fiber skis are a fairly new trend. It's the same stuff companies use to make modern hockey sticks or racing bikes out of. It's flexible, durable, and really lightweight.
If it's lighter, the skier is going to use less energy, and then therefore can take more runs because they're not so tired and just have a better day.
But they're also expensive. We're talking more than $1,000. Hunt compares these high-end skis to purchasing a new car.
You know, a Cadillac per se, versus kind of a low-end kind of entry, Chevy or Pontiac or whatever's out there these days.
And just like new cars, skiing is getting more and more high-tech. For instance, there are goggles that show your text messages as they come in, wearable tech that you can put in your boots to tell you if you're edging correctly. For novices out there, edging means how good or bad your technique is. And of course, for a while, you've been able to buy USB rechargeable heated gloves, boots, and jackets. Hunt says it all makes sense.
Going outside in the middle of winter for most people is not a pleasurable experience. So, you know, by having, you know, the best equipment, you know, having warm gloves, having, you know, good goggles so you have strong vision, you know, reduces all those negative things that come to mind when a lot of people think about, you know, going outside in a blizzard.
But being in a blizzard, bombing down a hill, wearing jeans and a cheap pair of gloves, that's how a lot of people out west used to ski. James Lynch is the outdoor gear editor for Popular Mechanics. And don't get him wrong, he loves a lot of this high-tech stuff. But Lynch also feels it kind of takes away from the struggle.
You know, the aspect of going outside into the outdoors and it not being comfortable.
In the olden days, he says, mountaineers and skiers, they look tough as nails.
You lose a little bit of that break the West kind of vibe that for a lot of time has been part of the outdoor adventure. The, you know, pushing yourself and seeing what you're capable of and having fun in that struggle.
But some people don't want to freeze their butts off on a mountain, or they want to go as fast as humanly possible down one, and they're willing to spend the money to do so. One market analyst group expects the ski equipment industry will be worth more than $5 billion by 2020. There's new products coming out constantly. Back at the ski factory, Alex Hunt shows off one of his company's newest inventions. It's called Phantom, and it looks like, well, clear goop.
I guess we could maybe compare it to the feel that you would get from like a vegetable oil.
Phantom costs around $100, but rub some on your skis, put them into a tanning bed, one for skis, not people, and you'll never have to buy wax again. Those skis, Hunt says, will go fast season after season. I ask him why people would spend that much money on stuff like this.
I think in general, there has been kind of a trend towards, I guess, more enjoyment and fulfillment in people's lives.
Nowadays, some people just want to have a little extra fun with their money.
And if that means, you know, spending some of that money on, you know, on more or less like toys.
Well, then that's good for Hunt's business and good for the ski hill. And talking about the ski hill, you might not even need one in the future. There are now virtual reality ski simulators in Los Angeles in Germany. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Next in our ski industry series, how climate change is transforming ski resort leaders into activists and lobbyists, the Mountain West News Bureau's Ali Budner reports.
Earlier this year, Aspen Skiing Company launched an edgy ad campaign called Give a Flake. A music video shows action shots of skiers and snowboarders shredding up mountains, while bright red letters in all caps flash across the screen, saying things like, if you love powder days, protect your passion, respect the mountain, join the movement. Christian Knapp is the head of marketing and sales for Aspen. He says they're trying to make people aware that climate change is affecting the industry. Then they're giving them tools to get involved.
There's a really cool Twitter widget where you can go in and put in your zip code, and it will pull up your state senators and representatives.
The app shows the user how those politicians have voted when it comes to climate issues.
So you can see if they give a flake or if they don't, and then you can choose to generate a tweet at them.
And for the non-digitally inclined, Aspen printed ads in outdoor sports magazines that are actually postcards.
That you can tear out, sign, and drop in a post office box and send directly to three Republican senators who are really swing votes on climate.
Aspen is also working with the Boulder-based nonprofit advocacy group Protect Our Winters, or POW as it's known. A couple years ago, POW hauled a 1970s-era phone booth to the base of Aspen Mountain.
And had people calling their elected officials to urge them to protect the methane rule that was up for a vote in the Senate.
That's Tori Udall with POW.
Many of the people had never called an elected official on any issue, and especially not on climate.
Udall says offering people easy advocacy opportunities when they come to a ski resort is key to building a movement of people who care. And they're not stopping there. Recently, POW took Aspen's Mr. Knapp to Washington. Knapp spoke to us from inside the halls of Congress on what turned out to be a historic day. Kavanaugh was testifying in his bid to become a Supreme Court justice.
So it was a lot of buzz in the Capitol, a lot of energy here.
About 30 other members of the snow sports community were there too, from ski resort representatives and gear brand owners to Olympic athletes.
We had some great meetings with some of the senators and representatives and both sides of the aisle, talking to them about climate legislation that can help our future in the snow sports industry.
Going to D.C. isn't for everyone, though. Mike Nathan is the sustainability manager at Arapahoe Basin, or A-Basin as it's called. It's a small ski area 80 miles west of Denver. He's been active on more local environmental issues. Nathan says political activism is important, but
I don't think we'd feel very right about touting this climate action and advocacy if we weren't actually doing anything here. You know, you got to walk the walk, too.
Which is why more and more resorts are trying to green their own operations. At A-Basin, for example, Nathan oversees several energy-efficient buildings and a waste reduction program. He says it saves money, but it's also about setting an example.
If some guest that skied here on a Saturday goes home and puts a compost bucket under their sink, I'm super happy.
He says they do sometimes get pushback.
We'll have a Facebook post around some sustainability win or a new project or an event or something. And there's always like one person that's like, oh, pfft. Great. A-Basin's political now. I guess I won't come. And then like 100 people jump on their back. We don't even have to say anything. They come to our defense.
Christian Knapp with Aspen Skiing Company echoes this sentiment.
I think more and more, you know, certainly millennial generation like to align themselves with businesses and brands that speak to their personal values.
Values like environmental sustainability. He points to companies like Patagonia.
They're basically an activist company. More than ever, and their sales are at record-setting levels. Nike saw a 30% increase in their e-commerce sales the week after the Colin Kaepernick ad campaign broke.
In other words, he says, taking a stand politically on climate change can also help a ski company's bottom line.
We do hope it does have a halo effect on our brand.
They'll see just how much as the current ski season gets underway. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
After the break, we'll find out about the assets now available for uranium mining and hear why more gas stations in Wyoming are now serving authentic Indian food. Not to be missed, right here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Melody Edwards. For the first time in the U.S., a uranium mine may soon be able to use an acid-based solution to commercially recover its resource. And the site is right here in Wyoming. It comes as a last resort for a company suffering under weak uranium prices. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Snow is falling over a long service road surrounded by nothing. Eventually, a few small pump jacks give way to an unassuming metal gate. It opens up to Strata Energy and its uranium mine. Inside a simply built office building, Ralph Canode greets me. He's the CEO. We walk over to a warehouse.
We also will be entering what's called a restricted area. That's a classification.
It's a large industrial room with pipes and ion exchange vessels where uranium is hauled into. Right now, those vessels pump an alkaline solution, the industry standard, through hundreds of nearby wells to recover uranium from aquifers below the surface. The solution used to pull the uranium out is essentially baking soda. But with weak uranium prices, that's not cutting it for Strata.
We have said publicly that at today's prices, the performance of this mine is not sustainable in the current market environment.
Uranium markets have been suffering from competitive renewable and natural gas prices for years, with plants closing down around the country. Wyoming is the number one provider of that uranium in the states. Since last April, Strata has been pursuing a new approach to mining that would extract more uranium. It wants to use a low pH solution, in other words, an acid solution. Canode says it would nearly double the rate of uranium recovery compared to the industry standard.
We believe it's a game changer for us, yes.
The company lists several other advantages to the acid solution, like less water consumption, faster extraction, and even improved groundwater restoration in some cases. Strata has already passed the first few regulatory steps to make the switch. And soon, it could become the first mine to use an acid solution to commercially recover uranium in the U.S. You might be wondering why every company isn't using acid leaching if it's so effective. Outside the U.S., they are. Acid leaching is the most common form of in-situ uranium extraction in the world. That's according to calculations from a 2017 World Nuclear Association report. Knode lists them off.
Australia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, to a lesser degree, Russia and China.
But the discussion whether to standardize acid leaching ended in the U.S. decades ago. Back then, several pilot tests raised concerns of groundwater contamination and restoring its original quality.
And since that time, the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission have really tried to get companies to shy away from acid leaching.
That's Shannon Anderson, staff attorney with the Powder River Basin Resource Council. A 1992 International Atomic Energy Agency report seconds that. Here's a quote.
The difficulty for restoring groundwater following acid leaching led to exclusive adoption of alkaline leach systems.
It's difficult to restore because pH levels were too low, and it took longer than the other solution. Plus, acid was causing a mineral to build up and hurt the flow rate. Strata lists off several other concerns as well in its own writing. And it does just sound scary. Without all this context, it just makes Wilma Tope nervous, who runs cattle near the mine. Her in-laws also live nearby.
I don't want to be in the more or less discarded zone. So I think that all landowners, most do feel that water is really precious.
And she worries, what would happen if the company had to close down, given they're already in a tough spot? Tope knows that acid is good at pulling uranium from the rock. Old tests show it's also good at pulling toxic elements out as well.
And then my question is, how is the cleanup going to go?
In Strata's white paper, it lays out the disadvantages, but adds modern techniques have overcome early challenges. Knode says only 1.5% of the solution is acid, that the aquifers are confined, meaning there's no connection to drinking water, and that the company isn't asking for any standards to be changed for groundwater restoration. Knode even says restoration should take roughly the same amount of time, though old tests show it took longer. With these assurances from the company, Powder River Basin Resource Council's Anderson says she doesn't oppose this project. She just worries about the precedent being set for all uranium companies in the Powder River Basin.
We're concerned about generally the state of the industry and don't want to see risky processes and procedures just okayed by our regulators, knowing that groundwater could be at risk.
Back at the site, Knode points out to where all the change will happen, out in this snowy field, where this site could become the first commercial mine using acid recovery in the U.S. for uranium.
Everything you see out there will systematically be converted once we receive full approval from the Wyoming DEQ.
And if they're successful, environmental advocates wonder if it will spark a tide change in uranium extraction across Wyoming and the country. Wyoming's Department of Environmental Quality is currently accepting public comment for the permit revision. That lasts until January 26th. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
In other environmental news, the United States recycling is piling up in China. And now China says they don't want it anymore. It's also becoming more expensive to collect and ship recycling from very small towns. But as Wyoming Public Radio's London Homer Wambeam reports, the shift in the recycling landscape may actually be better for the environment.
Wyoming residents probably haven't noticed much change in how cities collect recycling over the past year. But your bottles, cans, and paper may be going to different places than they were a year ago. At a large warehouse at the Laramie Landfill, Solid Waste Division Manager Brooks Webb stands near a vertical conveyor belt that pushes recycling up into a large bin.
We load it in, goes through the baler, and then we have a company that comes up and picks it up, and they haul the bales down to the facility in Denver, where they break the bales open and then they actually go through and do all the sorting.
But the facility in Denver is not its final destination. Most recycling used to go to China, nearly 45% of the world's plastic set for recycling. But now it's unclear where it will go, Vietnam, India, or someplace in the US. China has stopped importing nearly all plastic and paper recycling. Their new restrictions started a year ago, creating challenges around the world. Many communities, even Wyoming, are now struggling to find buyers for their materials, and more recycling is going to the landfill. But Webb says in Laramie, only 9% of recycling is going unrecycled. That's significantly better than the national average of 25%, according to the National Waste and Recycling Association. He says it's because Wyoming residents are good at keeping garbage out of it. And he says the relatively small amount the state produces has made it easier to find buyers. But Webb says recycling has become more expensive for communities.
So we used to actually get a rebate back for our materials. Now we're actually paying a tip fee. The cost have kind of switched to where we're basically paying more to get rid of the material now.
Despite this, Webb says recycling is still more cost-effective than putting the material in a landfill. The town of Jackson sends its waste to a landfill in Idaho. That's a big expense for the town that is offset by Jackson's profitable recycling program. Jackson makes more money on recycling because it asks residents to sort it. Heather Overholser, the superintendent of solid waste and recycling for Teton County, says there's a bigger market for pre-sorted recycling. Programs where residents put everything in one bin, that's called single-stream recycling, carry more contamination. For example, cardboard.
If there's plastic mixed in with it, or if there's food waste mixed in with it, that's considered contamination.
Contamination was one of the major reasons China stopped importing plastic and paper recycling. But Overholser says asking residents to sort their materials can also lead to fewer people bothering to recycle at all. According to a Harris poll, 66% of people say they wouldn't recycle if it wasn't easy to do. Overholser says people often forget about the other parts of the phrase reduce, reuse, recycle.
Reduction truly is the most important part of that. And so if you can figure out ways in your communities to reduce the waste that's being generated in the first place, that's ideal.
To reduce waste, Jackson is moving forward with an ordinance that will ban single-use plastic shopping bags. Plastic bags are not considered cost-effective to recycle, but some communities are weighing the benefits of recycling at all. Riverton is the only town in Fremont County that provides curbside recycling. Superintendent of Solid Waste Disposal Operations Andrew Frey says Fremont County's main goal is to protect the environment. Collecting and transporting small amounts of recycling uses a lot of fossil fuels. Frey says that's led the county to make some tough choices.
Does it make sense to collect product in far remote places like Jeffrey City or Lysite?
This is why most recycling programs in Wyoming don't accept glass. In most cases, emissions from transporting and recycling glass hurts the environment more than burying it in a landfill would. Plus, unsorted glass contaminates other recycling materials. Shipping recycling across oceans to Asia also has a hefty environmental cost. That's why Frey sees a silver lining in China turning down our plastic.
The carbon footprint around shipping product that far does not make sense when we have so much industry within the United States. And now what we're seeing is that domestic market is starting to come alive.
Frey says it's true recyclers are struggling to pick up the slack, but he says the best scenario is for U.S. recycling to actually get processed and reused right here in the U.S. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm London Homer-Wambi.
Speaking of trucking things, the trucking industry desperately needs more drivers. Right now, there's a record shortage. However, over the last couple of years, one demographic has been gravitating toward the industry by the thousands, Indian American Sikhs. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen has more.
Out here at ANC Truck Stop in southwestern Wyoming, the closest town is 20 miles away. Mintu Pandir has been a trucker for 16 years, but a few years ago, he decided to buy this truck stop as well.
So everybody said it's good money, and it's hard work.
He's made a few changes. One small building that used to be a fireworks stand is now a modest one-room Sikh temple. Pandir built the temple to accommodate the growing number of Sikh truckers traveling through his truck stop. According to the political organization Sikhs PAC, the trucking industry saw that demographic rise by 18,000 in 2017 alone. Pandir says it's an attractive blue-collar job for Sikhs like himself because it doesn't interfere with their beliefs or traditions.
You don't have to go, you know, cut your hair. You don't have to take your turban off, or you don't have to, lose your faith while you're working hard.
In fact, Pandir says days spent on the road reaffirm his faith.
The biggest thing in the Sikhism is service, serve other people. So there's no other industry you can better do than serve, because when you drive a truck, you deliver something. So it gives you the satisfaction. If you deliver food, you deliver fuel. Anytime you drive a truck, your ultimate destination is a delivery.
The soundtrack to this shift in the freight industry is Indian pop music. Sergi Khan's hit song Truck Union has over 2 million views on YouTube.
Trucking is actually becoming a pretty hip industry in Sikh community.
Khan's music video features turban dancers in flashy garments spinning in front of a row of shiny semi-trucks. Khan's lyrics describe working as a trucker as a straight shot to the American dream. Mintu Pander says a lot of Sikh truckers listen to it on the job.
You know, you can listen to your music all day while you're working. How many other jobs you can? Not too many.
Still, overall, Americans wanting this type of lifestyle is going down, and it couldn't happen at a worse time. Demand for trucking services are up, with online delivery companies like Amazon Prime becoming more and more popular. Bob Costello is chief economist with the American Trucking Association.
Trucks haul 70% of all the freight tonnage in the United States.
Right now, he says, trucking companies have a hard time hiring enough new people to keep up with the demand. And if the current trend continues, Costello says the shortage of drivers could surpass 174,000 by 2026. He says Sikhs entering the business could lighten the load.
Now, that's not going to solve the problem alone, but it's one of those things that will help a little bit.
Another bit of help? Sweetening the deal for truck drivers generally.
We saw pay increases every 6 months last year, right? We also saw things like, hey, come work for me. I'll give you, after you've been here for a little while, I'll give you a sign-on bonus. And many times that's, you know, thousands of dollars.
Costello says if it was all about money, it would be an easy problem to solve.
When you become a truck driver, especially a long-haul truck driver, this is a lifestyle choice that you are making.
That means long hours behind the wheel, sleeping in the cab of your truck, and long stretches of time without a home-cooked meal or seeing your family. But back at his busy truck stop, Mintu Pander says there are definite benefits, like the different states and vistas he gets to see, and the mountain passes where he often parks his rig for the night.
So, you know, sleeping on 12,000 feet, 11,000, that's like basically sleeping in the clouds.
Pandir drives mostly short distances these days and spends fewer nights on the road. That means more time spent managing the gas station. So Pandir has expanded services.
So this is the restaurant. Let's go inside.
Past the swinging door and into the kitchen, you can hear the hum of the traditional clay oven used in Indian cuisine.
And they cook in the tandoori chicken?
Chicken tikka masala,
so he's cooking that.
The menu is pretty extensive.
Lamb, goat. Yeah, but other than that, I mean, it's got chai latte, you got mango lassi, you got all the desserts you can eat.
This way, Pandir says, when a Sikh driver stops for fuel, they can also get a meal that tastes like home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Ahead, the prospect of live opera in Wyoming and a trek out to count birds, right here on Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. A new company is bringing live opera to Wyoming. After studying and performing in Las Vegas and New York City, Daniel Quintana now lives in Casper. He and his wife, Emily Quintana, have created Opera Wyoming. Daniel Quintana spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones.
So can you kind of tell me the story of how it started?
My wife is originally from Rock Springs, Wyoming. I'm originally from Wilmington, Delaware, and we met in Las Vegas. We were gondoliers at the Venetian Hotel and Casino. After a while, we did some opera with Opera Las Vegas, and that was actually both of our first foray into opera. The director there was a voice teacher named Judith Fredericks, and she convinced us to move to New York, so we studied some opera out there and did some opera. And then we moved back to Rock Springs in 2011. While we were there, we were doing these concerts with some of our friends in Las Vegas and also from New York. And those were very successful concerts. And then in 2013, we went to the Wyoming Arts Council under the guise of Opera Wyoming. And we had some, you know, nibbles here and there, wondering who we were and where we could perform. And then there's a little bit of a five-year hiatus. We moved to Casper, Wyoming in 2014. And then just this year, early in February, we just kind of said with a friend of ours who we met here in Casper, Johanna Swisher, it's like, why don't we just, you know, try to do this, you know, try to do Opera Wyoming and not have it just in Casper, but we'll be based in Casper, but try to bring opera throughout the entire state because no other opera company had done so in Wyoming. And so with the fiscal sponsorship from the Nicolaysen Art Museum, we are doing our first season. We've had a lot of interest outside of Casper, and that was our initial intention anyway, is to bring a lot of opera cultural to the surrounding towns in Wyoming.
What is it like to bring something like opera, which, you know, is a centuries old art form and what we predominantly think of as a pretty European or Italian art form? What is it like to bring something like that to Wyoming?
It's absolutely fantastic because at first there's such a trepidation because you're just wondering. We honestly thought, I think we're just doing this for ourselves. And then the very first concert, we had so many people thanking us for bringing it there. So it's amazing how this, basically this 420-year-old art form is finding a new market in Wyoming. And the reception has just been absolutely amazing because you have people who are just finding opera, and then you have people who have moved to Wyoming from major cities that had opera companies and just aren't able to get out to the opera like they used to.
What made you turn to opera?
It's just something that just kind of called to me. It kind of entered my life. So I always knew it was there, but then when the opportunity came, I just said, sure. So I went in head first.
The opportunity.
Opportunity. There you
go.
Yeah,
that was horrible.
We use it too. It's okay.
So I think anybody doing opera, especially in New York, is probably a small fish in a big pond. And now you're probably a big fish in a small pond. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what that's like?
Here's the interesting thing that we're finding. Yeah, we can admit that we're kind of the big fish in the small pond, but there seems to be like all these other fishies in the pond that we don't know about and have a major hidden talent, whether they used to sing opera or musical theater. And the folks that we've been finding, it's amazing. Like, we had one gentleman who studied at Indiana in his 20s and then moved to the medical profession. And then he's like, I don't even know why I'm even contacting you guys, but I'd like to audition for you. And he's this amazing tenor who lives here in Casper, and he hasn't sung, and he sounds amazing. What the whole hope is that we'll be able to do collaborations within each town. So we'll have like a group, you know, a group of three or four people within Opera Wyoming. But as we travel throughout the towns, we'll hold like auditions prior to any performances and do collaborations with the people already living there. So that way we're really making sure it's still Wyoming accessible. And if the need comes that we need to bring somebody in from one of our friends from New York or Las Vegas, you know, then we'll do so. But we're really trying to keep it Wyoming.
Can you tell me about the next show that you have?
The next show is called Shakespeare Goes to the Opera, and it's based on a show that we did in New York in, I believe, 2009. We did it in collaboration with the Old Vic's New Voices program in New York. And so basically, we took scenes from Shakespeare, and then we also tried to find the correlations either in musical theater or opera and told the basic Shakespeare story, interspersing the drama with the music. We had so much music and so many options to consider that we probably will be doing another Shakespeare Goes to the Opera next season because there are just so many shows and so many choices. This particular show, we will have Romeo and Juliet, Macbeth, and also Taming of the Shrew. That'll be interspersed with opera and musical theater.
So after this season, what are your plans? What are your hopes?
After this season, my wife and I actually right now are kind of planning 3 to 5 years out right now. Because we are based in Casper, we still like to do some things within the community. But we're supposed to be going to Rock Springs possibly in March or April to do a collaboration with them for an arts festival. And one of the big things we really would like to do is sort of a traveling fringe festival during the summer for Wyoming. So it'll be a little bit of opera, a little bit of musical theater and drama, whatever else we can attract, and just kind of do a traveling fringe here and there.
That's Opera Wyoming co-founder Daniel Quintana talking with Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones. Opera Wyoming continues their first season with Shakespeare Goes to the Opera on Friday at the Nicolaysen Art Museum in Casper. Now, from human song to bird song. The Bates Hole Christmas Count is one of the last rural bird counts in the nation. Citizen scientists spend part of the holidays counting birds to help inform trends in bird population. Bird counts like this one have been happening for the last 119 years. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner tagged along to see what keeps bird enthusiasts flocking to Bates Hole.
Where the narrow place is, one Red Creek goes.
The morning of New Year's Day, the temperature outside is negative 15 degrees as I walk to Charlie Scott's farmhouse. But the chilliness hasn't deterred participation in the Bates Hole bird count, because by 7:30 a.m., around a dozen volunteers are gathered in the kitchen. Over coffee, they think through the day's plan, and I get a crash course in birding. It's something I have never done before. Charlie and his brother Stacy peer over a laminated map of the bird count area.
There might be something, you see right here where it crosses Little Red Creek, this might be worth exploring a bit,
okay,
on foot.
Both brothers know Wyoming and its birds well. They started birding with their dad when they were kids. Charlie's been hosting the Bates Hole bird count since 1978.
I don't know what you might find up in there.
Over last sips of coffee, Charlie and Stacy banter about the birds they hope to see today.
We do have some rough legs in, but not as many as we have in the past.
I think I had 20 before I saw myself.
Bates Hole isn't much of a town, just a group of houses. And while there is an urban bird count less than a half an hour's drive away in Casper, these bird enthusiasts want to experience a truly distinctive birding event. Everyone forms groups, and we head off to our designated areas to search for birds. Charlie Scott leads us between sage and snowdrifts. I look through my binoculars at tree sparrows and black-billed magpies that use the ranch's cows as their perch. Birds are more likely to be found next to open water sources that aren't iced over. We look around irrigation ditches and along the banks of Stinking Creek. And I actually spot something.
Oh, right here. Oh, turkeys.
Turkeys right here. 1, 2, 3, 4. That was hard?
Did you see that? Like, no! What?
That's Jason Finkel. He's originally from the East Coast, so he's learned a new set of birds moving out west a few years ago. He's participated in the Casper count, too, but he enjoys the variety out of Bates Hole. He's used to counting birds at bird feeders.
It's different from being in town. It's different. They're not all feeder birds, which is really cool.
All that open space makes bird spotting difficult, but there are also few trees or buildings to obstruct the birder's view.
I think that's what it is for us, is the, you know, the aha moments. You never know what you're going to find, and if you don't go out and look for them, you're never going to see them.
As we continue our trek, we think we see a shrike. A gray, innocent-looking bird with an unusual mating ritual.
The shrikes take their insects that they catch, and they impale them on spikes and barbed wire fences and things like that to show females how good they are at catching things.
That is the best thing I've heard.
It's funny to see you come along and here's a whole bunch of impaled.
Yeah, little grasshoppers, stuff like that.
Charlie's dad, Oliver Scott, founded the local chapter of the National Audubon Society. Oliver Scott taught popular classes about birding at Casper Community College and wrote a book titled A Birder's Guide to Wyoming. The book details maps to locations and descriptions of Wyoming's famous birds like the sage grouse. That's one bird I especially wanted to see. Growing up in Wyoming, I've never seen one. Charlie explains why his bird count is special.
And we have a good deal of sage grouse habitat within the circle. Just the nature of this place. And I think we'll wind up with having seen quite a few sage grouse today.
Soon the count is over and all the groups get together again for dinner. Flushed faces, including my own, file in for lasagna. Everyone is chatting about the day's discoveries, And I am particularly proud of my 16 wild turkeys and 10 sage grouse. This was the best attended Bates Hole Christmas count in many years, and that's not the only new development. This year, the group saw blue jays for the first time, as well as an uptick in ravens. Before the 80s, those were never spotted here. Jason Finkel describes the appeal of birding for a newer generation.
It's like Christmas. You never know what you're going to see. We like to find the weird stuff.
In all, we tallied 2,423 individual birds and 45 different species. I left Bates Hole with a brand new love of rural birding adventures and hopes that the Bates Hole bird count continues its tradition for many more years. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
Thanks so much for joining us for Open Spaces. You can hear today's show again and listen to all our stories at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also sign up for the Open Spaces podcast there, and we always appreciate when you rate it and leave us your comments. If you have good ideas for future stories, let us know. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.